Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast. Fish are amazing creatures with a diversity of colors, shapes, and sizes. They truly are a diverse group of animals, and so are humans. This podcast is more about people than fish, which is also the case in fisheries, believe it or not. Any fisheries manager will tell you, it's about working with people. The fish are the easy part.
Here we focus on people and on extremely important topics, including the benefits of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the field of fisheries and aquatic sciences. Some topics may be uncomfortable at times, but this will be a safe zone from which everyone can learn. Although this is an initiative led by graduate students and supported by the American Fisheries Society and the Fisheries Podcast, it applies everywhere and to everyone and transcends fisheries.
We strive for everyone to feel involved and included, no matter your country of origin, age, ethnicity, gender, religion, sexuality, and/or disability. Hosts and guests are sharing their personal views, which they hold as their own.
Humans struggle between what is right and wrong. Our personal morals and ethics are shaped by cultural norms and the ones that surround us, including our family, friends, classmates, and colleagues. Our podcast would like to critique your philosophy by challenging some of your personal beliefs regarding right and wrong.
We are so glad you chose to listen and open your mind to these very important conversations. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, everybody, and thanks for joining the Fisheries Diversity and Inclusion Podcast. Today is part two of a two-part series with Dr. Yvonne Arizmendi. We'll be taking a deep dive and discussing some of the issues that he brought forward in his seminar in part one. Please enjoy. First of all, we're going to give Dr. Todd Petty a moment to address the group and also to welcome and ask the first question to Dr. Arizmendi. So I'll hand over the floor to Dr. Petty there.
Oh, well, sure. I'm happy to do that. First, thanks for such a great turnout out there. I like to see all of these participants. And of course, what a great visit we have from Dr. Arizmendi. But I'm going to start by welcoming you as a fellow lover of stream fishes. Fish lovers are always welcome around here, of course. Second thing I really want to do is thank you for your hard work and courage in promoting increased diversity in our professions. It's really people like you that serve as role models for everyone. And from a perspective like mine, it has an emboldening effect for people like me, who are people from a privileged identity. It gives us a little spark of courage and a little spark of passion, put in our own hard work to push that. I like your metaphor of pushing that train, because that's really what it is. It's a train. No one single person can push it. You know, if we all hop behind it and it's not too steep a hill, we can do it. So I really appreciate that work from folks like you. Aaron asked me to speak from the perspective of a department chair for a department that's whose job is to train, to attract, to retain, and train that next generation of professionals. And if we are sincere about increasing our diversity, it's departments like ours that are going to start moving that needle. And there's a couple things that I think are beginning to resonate, and you really have touched on both of those here. And I think it's starting to take hold in folks' minds. You know, the first is that our professions, in fact, do suffer when they lack diversity. It's a provable fact. It's not one that we've thought about, but it's so obvious, right? And so if I'm a department chair and I say I want to double research expenditures over the next 10 years, it's a reasonable thing for a department chair to say. I think what your data would show and others is that if I don't increase the diversity of my workforce and the workplace, that's going to be harder to do, that it's easier to do when we're more diverse. It's easier to have those big ideas take shape and produce outputs. I think the second thing that's beginning to take shape and resonate in our departments is that our lack of diversity, you know, it's hard to identify the root causes of that, but part of it is a systemic dysfunction in our workplaces, not one that we necessarily intend to create, but one that's there. And it's a dysfunction in the culture of our workplaces. And so as a department chair, I consider it my job, and perhaps even the most important part of my job, is to change that workplace culture from one of exclusivity to one of complete inclusivity. And that doesn't fix all of the problems, but it's certainly one that we can control. Four things what we're committed to. First, we've decided we are going to listen to women and to people of color about what it means to be truly inclusive in our as a department. We're going to amplify their message when we hear it, and we're going to confront these things that are there, these dysfunctions, if you will, that are in our culture, and try to work our way through it. And then finally, and this is something that is really important, I really appreciate the podcaster's role in this. They play a big role in it, and it's a big part of the rhetoric, if you will, of of that I like to use, and that's that we'll be inclusive out loud all the time. The analogy I use is there's no question I have two sons and a wife, and there's no question I love them, right? But if I never say it, if I never act like it, you know, what's it for? And so if it's not enough to say we want to be inclusive and attract a diverse workforce, it's we have to live that, and we have to do it daily. We have to wake up and put on that hat. And again, I'll return to the top of, you know, my comment. Again, it's folks like you, Dr. Arismendi, that serve as that role model and serve an emboldening role. And I appreciate it. So my question for you is, in your opinion, what are the three most important things that we should be doing as a department to demonstrate our commitment to inclusivity and to move the needle on increasing diversity in our profession?
Well, thank you for the question and for your words. And if I need to think about that, and well, this is an existing problem that we haven't solved before. So we are not going to see other places that we can use it like a model. So this is kind of a adaptive management that we use, right, in fisheries, in other professional. We learn from what we do at the same time. So we do a step, we evaluate, and then make the decision if we can keep doing that or switch to a different approach. I would say, based on what I know, what we have done a little bit here, is like the first thing is really important is have a climate survey or like an assessment of the status of each institution. So basically, I acknowledge that there are intrinsic natural differences between regions, states, universities, realities, funding, the composition of faculty and students. So all these idiosyncratic aspects need to be considered in order to have an assessment about the status of diversity and inclusion in the own unit. In this case, could be a lab unit, department unit, college unit. So the point one will be making the assessment on those. The second one is, based on those responses, prioritize what is going to be a diversity and equity and inclusion plan in order to tackle those issues that become more important depending on each idiosyncratic responses, right? Thinking about plan for how you can increase the undergrad recruitment from minorities, graduate recruitment, and also professional development for faculty and for personnel at the department level too. So assessment, then making a plan with deliverables and also actionable items that you can evaluate year by year. And one thing in particular that is affect, I would say, personally and other people as a faculty level, we have the heavy role to recruit people from the top down level. Hey, faculty need to recruit people for underrepresented group, but there is no tools to do that. How you can, we talk about, I was giving a presentation in California. One of the questions I have, every single minute that you spend in diversity issues, you are not spending in writing papers, especially in institutions that really are one, like heavily in research. If we don't consider diversity and inclusion work in your position descriptions and your annual evaluation and just weigh that and evaluate that, is going to be really hard for faculty to move resources and time. So it has to be a culture about changing that and showing that it's really important for annual evaluation that you are, could be training, could be recruiting people, could be doing an outreach and evaluate the, at the same level that you do your other duties of research, teaching, and service, right? As part of that position description, that would be my third more detail in terms of faculty, especially because faculty has a lot of power in this to make changes, right? Recruiting people, teaching others, doing research with others, and creating these collaboration networks. So that will be my three-step assessment plan, adapted plan, and then position descriptions.
Great. Thank you. And thanks for everything. Again, I know we've got a lot of questions you're going to get hit with here. So I'll sit back and listen. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
As we begin to sort of shift gears into podcast mode and Q&A mode, I'd like to start out by just kind of introducing everybody here. We have the Clemson University's Natural Resources Graduate Student Association here. Here today representing them is the NRGSA's DEI committee, two individuals, Keith Phelps and Alex Jensen. Keith and Alex, thanks so much for being here today. If you don't mind giving all of us listeners a brief description about the NRGSA, as well as the group's DEI committee, we'd all love to hear.
Sure. Thanks for having us on today. So the NRGSA student body is just a student organization that really works to promote the community of grad students. We hold monthly meetings where we all kind of get together. We also hang out with professors, and we have various committees that do tasks. So the Diversity and Inclusion Committee working with our department in order to promote diversity, inclusion, and equity, specifically some action items that we've drafted, or we've drafted a document for initiatives that grad students wish the department to sort of facilitate and move forward. And we're also brainstorming various other ideas, such as surveys and collaborating with other student organizations.
Awesome. So I'm going to jump in again. Hi, I'm Cassidy. I am a new added co-host to the Fisheries Diversity Podcast. I think this is my podcast voice. I'm not really sure. NRGSA DEI Committee has some questions that were put aside for today. So I'll go ahead and throw it back to Keith Phelps, who has our first question for Dr. Arizmendi.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Arizmendi, thank you for being here. My first question is, how did you first become involved with advocating for diversity and inclusion?
Well, actually, that was unintended and also unexpected. I grew up in southern Chile, and I went to a really small university, probably 800 students. And I had a lot of male and female teachers, so they kind of shaped what I was thinking about being a graduate student there. And then I moved here. Well, of course, I was working there for a while, like a technician, many projects in there. And then moved here in the U.S. to a land grant institution like Clemson, Oregon State, as finishing my PhD, and then I started a postdoc. So it was a huge change in terms of competitiveness and how is the research environment. And it's not like it's basically a major leagues right from a small university. And also my wife started a PhD here, and we both were like wondering about what's going on here. Like, what, nobody invite us? What don't people ask you questions? Own view? Is this real? Do we have diverse people here than other than that? And that basically started our idea of, you know, can we evaluate this? And because I'm an engineer as a training, undergrad training, I'm also a quantitative person. So can we quantify this? Can we show other people if we are good, right or not? And after giving some presentation, people approach us and say, well, this is real. This is great, because I always talk to my supervisor about crew leaders in the field. They're all men. No woman there. So I told them that it's lack of women in this profession, and they told me, no, you are wrong. This is just, you think about that. Things like that, I think, were first motivation that we have in order to making this area of emerging research for us. But again, it was unintended and unexpected.
Alex Jensen has also been really important to this DEI committee within RGSA, putting that together and helping lead. I've been real impressed with both him and Keith and others putting this whole thing together and working with Dr. Petty and others. It's been really cool to see. And he's going to kick off our next question. So our next couple of questions. Have at it, Alec.
All right. Thanks, Aaron. Yvonne, thank you for the talk. It was awesome. My first question is about recruitment. You know, I see in every job ad that there's this non-discrimination policy, right? We don't discriminate based on race, ethnicity, et cetera. But then lately in the last maybe 5 years, and even when I've posted job ads, I put this little blurb saying, like, we encourage, you know, minoritized students to apply, right? And I guess I just have trouble kind of reconciling those sometimes. And so where do you land on that? And how do you recruit kind of without being discriminatory, but still being inclusive?
That's a great question. I think the solutions in order to recruit people from minoritized group has to be a little bit more creative now. One of the things that is really be really important to attract people from minority is, like you just mentioned, that is basically don't put these lines at the end of your recruitment advertisement, right? Put it in front or put it in the central point that people, this is real. It's not like a copy paste statement that we see in all these, you know, position, this call for position at different levels, at the university level most of the time. Bringing this to a more central portion of that will tell the reader that this is really important is first there. So don't be afraid to be in front asking for diverse people that we need you. I need you to improve our profession, rather than making the impression that you are doing the opposite, like, oh yeah, we need to recruit diverse people, so we're making you a favor recruiting you. So I think that changes in the culture, that just a small change will make people more attracted to go to those places.
Recruiting people of minority without being discriminatory, but to be inclusive, what kind of recruitment would not be effective, if that's what you're saying? or be harmful, because I wasn't sure what you meant by that statement.
Well, the way that I thought people may think about that is like, there's two ways, right? Is we have this backlash here with some pushing for diversity scholarships, right? That and that happened in California too, like pushing from people that feel that people from white background will be discriminated. So, and the other pushback or thinking is that people that are giving this scholarship, they feel that they were given just because they are diverse and not because of their own merit, like academic or talented people. So that the idea of like trying to, you know, be really in front of that and clear about that is common. And I think it has to be with people is not educated, that they don't understand that when people think about white privilege, it's not because you are not being working hard to get where you are, right? This is the big difference that people, when they hear about white privilege, it's not nobody give you things for free. This is not the argument. The argument is the whole structure of the society tend to benefit people that is white and is culturally, you know, is subtle sometimes, but it's not because they don't deserve it. I think I think people, when they start learning a little bit more about that, they have this aha moment that say, okay, yeah, I can say white privilege without feeling offended, because it's not meant to be as I get things that for free that I didn't do any effort.
Thank you for answering that.
Sort of about recruitment too, but kind of maybe a broader view. You talked about the leaky pipeline without kind of saying it explicitly, you know, particularly for women where you get high levels and there's just fewer women, right? As an example, where are the most important holes in the leaky pipeline? I mean, how important is doing outreach at K-12 versus retaining undergraduates in our field and then even beyond that?
So the leaky pipeline is kind of some concept that people put it related to, you know, we have a pool of people coming in the same level, and then if you move up in the career, they start to do, you know, lose people, making switches in careers, moving to a different type of jobs, and just forgetting about academia. So I think I can imagine this like a pyramid, right? We have people from K-12 on the bottom, really a huge population of potential people that will be interested in science, and they move up and you have a small pyramid based on what is happening in their own lives. So I think the recruitment has to be at all levels, and we can have some recruitment, heavy recruitment at the K-12 level, giving outreach solution for those kids to get, in my case, in stream ecology, we create camps that bring them to the river, like flow the river, take out, look what is behind, below these rocks, see insects, see diversity, investigate this. So bring this curiosity at that level. And then for the top level, like undergrad, graduate level, postdoc and faculty, we need to work a little bit more on the inclusion and promotion and leadership of those, because we already have few people there that made it at that stage. But sometimes people are exhausted, that they are always thinking about leaving the career because of the lack of, you know, inclusion and promotion. So for the case of undergrad level, for example, I can say that having a good research experience could be a sparking point in order to go to grad school and become more interested in science. And that opportunity can be done early on their careers. So having more inclusive lab that include undergrad research, especially for minorities, will provide these kind of opportunities to them to experience and get interested in that.
I like that. And I like that you took your quantitative skills and using them in this context, just kind of generally. So that's cool.
I had a question. So you mentioned camps to kind of get high school students for recruitment, essentially, and to kind of pique that interest in the sciences. I might have missed it. Did you say that you have camps like that, or do you just kind of know of those kinds of organizations that do that?
Actually, we created a camp with another colleague from Oregon State University, Dr. Guillermo Giannico. We thought about providing a 7th and grade graders an idea about watershed science. We created a camp for them with the funding from Mayer Memorial Trust here in Oregon. So basically we recruit like 30 undergrads from underserved group coming to OSU campus. They were sleeping on campus, having kind of a life of undergrad, getting cars to, you know, have lunches at the university housing and dining. So they can have meals, they can sleep there, experience a little bit of life on campus during summer. There is no fuel of students. And then we bring them to the river. So we went to the mountain. We have a merit peak here close to Corvallis. So in order to say, well, here, everything is started here in this mountain. The water is starting flowing downstream there and experience all these changes. And you can see from the horizon, from the merit peak, you can see the ocean and see the whole watershed coming down there. And then we move to different land uses, looking for agricultural land uses, a complex landscape with forestry. You see cities in the middle. And then we did some float in the river. So basically we raft the Willamette River here, the main stem, which is really mild. And we talk about processes and people, and they were jumping there, swimming, go back. So having this kind of a fun at the same time educational experience, they were really interested in these insects and fish that they can see there. And we have many campers that we like to do every year now. From those, we have two or three that are in undergraduate levels, and they have this kind of a little bit of curiosity for freshwater processes. So yeah, we created a camp for providing that spark. Unfortunately, we get run off of funding, but things like that could be really inspiring for people for underserved communities. They usually don't do that type of activity.
That's awesome. We talked earlier about, you know, what sparking that interest into fisheries for, I just love that idea and what you're doing. I think that's going to really create a lot of beginning stories for folks who are end up pursuing the sciences professionally. So that was really great for you to share that. Thank you. Keith or Alex, did you guys have any other questions you would like to ask?
So Dr. Arizmendi, how are you thinking about differences in approach and tactics for increasing diversity and inclusion and equity across different slices of the world? Workforce. So we've concentrated a lot on academia, but what do you think are some differences for undergraduates, state, federal agencies, technicians, even public sector work?
So I think is that this is not only a problem in academia, right? We see the same lack of diversity and inclusion in businesses and in other type of organizations. So I think what is important is rethinking structures of these organizations and institutions, like mission statements, assessment plans and actions had to be at all levels. Thinking a little bit more about recruit, we have really a success model to recruit sports, people from doing sports, really a successful recruitment and model that we go to high school looking for talented people in different sports and we bring it to the university. I think we can use a similar model to recruit talented minorities to bring it to the university. We can use those experiences to do that.
Awesome. Thank you.
Great. So now we're going to shift gears and we're going to hear from Meredith Bean. She has a great question for Dr. Arizmendi. Meredith, could you please introduce yourself and go ahead and ask your question?
Hi. Yeah, I'm a master's student in the Forestry and Environmental Conservation Department. And I just wanted to ask you, do you know of any mutual aid networks or funds in place for helping to support grad students from underrepresented populations? Because once they've jumped through that first hoop of getting into school, we've seen there's another hoop of finding housing and affording to replace a broken laptop or completing fieldwork safely alone in remote areas. So I just wanted to ask your feedback on that.
Yeah, sure. So actually, this is everybody's problem. I have to start the answer with that, because seems to be a lot of pressure on faculty to recruit people from diverse backgrounds. And actually, I would argue that this is more like a college university policy problem. And of course, it's everybody's problem, right? Limited funding is a really hard problem. And faculty usually burdened to trying to find this research funding or TA, stuff like that, to fund students, right? But sometimes you need additional help from the university. So I think at the college level, at university level, they need to actively provide funding to do this. If they really believe that this strategically is going to be a long-term investment to have better problem solving, have a better impact of the science, they need to invest on diversity and inclusion. So they need to provide funding in order to cope with this problem that you just mentioned about housing, about support people from underserved groups that have less competitiveness in terms of equality during their own life. So I think is the mission statement of the university and colleges need to be revised and need to be updated, and also being be accountable. So if you really want to push this, we need to see leadership from university at the college level to ask for this. And we can ask professional societies to also to partnership on this. So there is a lot of ways to we can improve the funding issues.
All right. Are there any other questions from either Meredith or Alex and Keith?
So my last question would be, what are your thoughts on ways to acknowledge and resist colonial legacies in scientific research, specifically in regards to forestry, ecological management, and wildlife ecology? I guess a big point in that would be, like, are land acknowledgement statements alone enough, and should we be doing more?
Yes, we should do more. And I think words are the first step, but they are not enough at this moment. I think we are in the moment in the history in this country that we need to move from the acknowledgement to a little bit to the planning and to the action. Acknowledging the problem is part of this, you know, a statement about the land and recognition to that. We need to plan an action and bring, for example, Native American to the table and just treat different groups and equally. So without this acknowledgement, we cannot move forward. So it's kind of a, yes, it's valuable, but I think it's not enough, especially now with more people is aware about these issues, and we consciously can now decide if you want to be part of the solution or not.
Are there any other questions from our audience members? We still have a great turnout. We had about 40, 50 people on here. We really appreciate that. All right. We have a question from Kayla. Go for it, Kayla. Thank you.
Hello, Dr. Arispendi. Thank you for your presentation and for all the education. I just wanted to introduce myself. I'm biracial, Latina, and Caucasian. First, I wanted to know about your, I noticed you had Latinx at the in your biography, and I just was wondering if you could explain a little bit about that, what that means to you, just so I can understand it. And I was wondering if you had any information about people with on the autism spectrum in research.
All right, let me unpack your question. Let's go first with the Latinx word. I learned this here. Usually you use Latina if you are a female, use Latino if you are a male, and somehow people refer to the Latino community in like overall. Basically, Latinx means that this is a Latin community including all genders. So I'm not basically genderized the word like it's a male word like Latino is in Spanish. So that's the main reason of the Latinx. So you'll see a lot of that now. It's not referring for any gender. It's gender neutral term related to that.
That was a great question. I had the same response. I've seen that in different places, and I just learned something there. Thank you, Yvonne.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's avoid to genderize the word. But in the Spanish community, we don't use much more. It's mostly for the English community that we use here. So related to the other type of diverse diversities, I think is like, so which advisor are you picking? Because there is many style to advise people, I guess. Some advisors are more hands off. So basically they give you, here's the problem, come back to me and bring me the solution, be active. I expect you to be independent. Some people need more advice, and some people need even more working together in this road. I'm thinking about grad school mostly. It's depending who you pick or who the person pick is really important, because you would like to have an environment that you feel included, right? So you maybe need to find an advisor that is able to walk the road depending on your own preferences and way to learn that are a little bit non-traditional. So I would say that this is really important, and more than the institution is having a landing in a good lab that is basically a good fit between you and your advisor. That would be my advice. And people can be successful in any of these styles. And it's depending on the preference of the people, right? How the person feel more comfortable. So having an honest conversation with advisors, I think, is really useful to make sure that you will succeed at the end of your time.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm just starting to unpack that for myself. And I appreciate how you said that science, that you want to make clear that science is available to everyone.
Thinking about, I was moving to teach from in-person to online. Many people are more comfortable, rather than speaking loud in class. Some people are really more comfortable explaining in chat rooms. They can ask more questions. They are more opinionated in chat room rather than speaking in front of the whole class. So I was always wondering about, wow, we were not having the participation of these people before when we have in-person class because they were shy. They have a different perspective, right? But then in this online version of the classes, they are really, really expressive. And again, learning styles are more diverse than we thought. And I'm still learning about that.
Well, I'd say this has been a great podcast, a great recording session. We really appreciate everybody's involvement. Dr. Yvonne Arizmendi for taking the time all the way from the West Coast to spend with us. It's been fun. I've learned a lot. It's really cool how you confronted it with data. That's one of my biggest takeaways is you're not just talking about it. You're confronting things with data, which is evidence-based, speaks to you as a scientist, and that's what's going to get other scientists to buy in.
Again, I personally just want to give Dr. Arizmendi my thanks for coming and sharing all of his knowledge with us and his findings. I have plenty of notes written down. I can't wait to share it with some of my own friends outside of here.
Again, Dr. Arizmendi, thank you. Thank you so much. I really enjoy hearing you speak and share your data and your thoughts on everything. I was also just camp program because I just think when I was a kid, how much I would have loved stuff like that. My dream is to do that kind of work. So I'm going to definitely check out the summer camp thing as well. And hopefully, you know, in the future, there'll be a lot more different programs for kids of all ages, and we're going to get all of them outdoors, no matter where they come from, what they look like, what they identify as. So thank you again, Dr. Arizmendi.
So Dr. Petty, why don't you have the final word with Yvonne, and then we'll wrap it up.
Well, sure. I'll definitely keep it simple, and just a final thank you. Been great for all of the folks that have stuck around and heard your answers. We hope you've enjoyed it. So my final question is just sort of a forward-looking one. You know, rate yourself on a scale of 1 to 10 on optimism for our professions.
I would say 8 or 9 for the next generation. I would say 5 or 6 for this generation if we keep pushing.
I share your optimism, and I share it under the assumption that we keep pushing, that we keep our foot on that gas pedal. And again, it's from the perspective of our profession has suffered as a result. And if we're true professionals, then we got to push. Okay, well, thank you again. And thank you all for the hard work of putting all this together and the continued hard work on this topic.
Thank you very much. It was nice. It was nice to see so many people there.
Special thanks to the Fisheries Podcast for hosting us on their established feed at fisheriespodcast.podbean.com. And for also tackling important diversity and inclusion topics in their normal feed. Also, find us and other diversity and inclusion resources on diversity.fisheries.org. The custom lo-fi music beat was crafted by Darius Armstrong. Look for his music name, Karl Marx, on www.bandcamp.com/releases. We are very grateful to all those AFS leaders and members who have provided support and feedback as we have brought this podcast to life.